Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The news is that 2 years after we've said genocide, that it's still going on and it's increasing. And that somewhere in there, we can all talk about this and make speeches and say this is horrible and we have to do something. But every day we don't do something, and every day that this goes on, thousands of people are dying.
That was
dying horrific deaths.
Actor George Clooney speaking on ABC on Sunday after returning from Darfur. And 3 years into the conflict there, and after the deaths of more than 200,000 people, the Sudanese government and rebel fighters are working beyond a Sunday deadline to end the genocide. A deal seemed close on Sunday, but the rebels refused to sign on, and now the talks are into a 48-hour extension with a new deadline of midnight tonight. Yesterday, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick flew to the region in a last-ditch effort to bring an end to the fighting. But the Sudanese representative fled when an agreement wasn't reached. Joining me now to look at whether an agreement can be reached and whether peace might finally come to the region are New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who, as you probably know, has devoted dozens of columns to the genocide, and he recently won a Pulitzer for his work on this. Also with us is Samantha Power, executive director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and the author of Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, published in 2003 by HarperCollins. Welcome back to you both to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Nicholas, what's the nature of the peace deal being agreed to, officially anyway, by the government of Sudan, and would it really stop the genocide?
Well, it certainly is a necessary step. The problem is that there have been peace deals and ceasefires and promises in the past from Sudan and also from the rebels, and they tend to be completely dishonored. And so I think it's very important that Robert Zoellick flew to Nigeria to try to get this to actually happen. And in theory, it would involve demobilization of the Janjaweed militia that has been responsible for this. But I also think that, if it actually does come to pass, we'll have to put an awful lot of pressure on both sides to make sure that it is actually implemented.
Samantha, from what I've read, it's the rebels right now, that is the groups representing the people of Darfur, who are balking at this because of various reasons. They don't think it gives them enough representation. They're afraid it won't stop the killing. And there's also bickering among different rebel factions. How do you understand their opposition?
Well, we're in a tricky bind here, because you don't secure civilians for the most part. The international community tends not to secure the welfare of civilians until after a peace deal has been struck. Yet, if your people are still being murdered, as they were even yesterday, to coincide with the big rallies across America, the Sudanese launched another attack against another village, I think killing 40 people and wounding 200.
You say to coincide. Do you think they knew that those rallies were taking place here and they were trying to stick it to us?
I think that the correlation is not coincidental. There's a remarkable recurrence of coincidental attacks that coincide with statements and initiatives, in the United States and by the United States. But the point is that we countries don't want to send their troops to offer into harm's way. Basically, Darfur is scary not only to the people of Darfur but to many governments that might be contemplating, could we send peacekeepers? Will we? Won't we? So they want to wait for a peace deal in order to do that. But until civilians are actually safe, the rebels are also, of course, rooted in communities where that just don't trust the Sudanese government, that are still being attacked by the Sudanese government. So it would take significant assurances as well as significant representation and power sharing and so on, I think, for the rebels to feel confident that they weren't letting their people down by putting their signature in stone.
This is WNYC, and we can take some phone calls for Nicholas Kristof and Samantha Power on the situation in Darfur, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, we played that George Clooney clip at the beginning, saying basically the Darfur conflict has been so prolonged in part because of public apathy. Do you share this view? And if so, what have you done to help bring about the change? Were you at one of those rallies on Sunday? Have you called your congressman, written any letters? What kind of response did you get? Let us know. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Nicholas, the Times report on this today quoted a Sudanese diplomat who said the government might have erred in so quickly accepting the deal because it gave the impression that it was more favorable to the government than to the rebels. Do you know if that's the perception among the rebels, and how favorable do you think it is to the government, really?
I'm not sure that I would buy that. I think it was useful to get the government to sign onto it. The problem is, I mean, as Samantha says, that the rebels are incredibly suspicious of the government, and they do have good reason to be. But I also think that, frankly, that the rebels are thugs as well, and they have attacked each other's villages. The main two tribes in the rebels are the Zagawa and the Fur, and so Zagawa rebels, for example, have been slaughtering Fur tribesmen. I have very little sympathy for the rebels sitting in hotel suites in Nigeria, kind of twiddling their thumbs as their people are slaughtered. But I also do think that there is no moral equivalence, that the rebels, for all their problems, they may be thugs, but they're not genocidal thugs, and that fundamentally the problem here is the Janjaweed, which is armed and supported and paid for by the Sudanese government.
Well, you talk about the rebels as thugs. Maybe you should give us some background, because I'm sure a lot of listeners don't know who these rebels are. We usually hear about the genocide being carried out in Darfur by Janjaweed militia on behalf of the Sudanese government, but we don't really hear about the Darfurians as rebels or fighting themselves.
Sure.
What's the nature of the rebellion and its armed factions?
Sure. What happened is that in Darfur, you have this kind of marginalized area where there has been some historic tension between Arab tribes and non-Arab tribes, and that's also exacerbated by the fact that the Arabs tend, by and large, to be nomadic herdsmen, and the African tribes tend to be settled farmers, so they're competing for forage, for water. There's also, to some degree, a racial distinction in that the Arabs tend to be lighter-skinned, the Africans tend to be darker-skinned, but these lines are all fuzzy. And then, increasingly, there was an Arab supremacist ideology coming in that was kind of infecting some of the Arab tribes. The Arab government in Khartoum was supporting the Arab tribes whenever there was a quarrel over livestock or over forage. And as a result, the Arab tribes increasingly began to just attack non-Arab African villages. And the result was that in 2003, this rebel movement was born to try to demand protection for the African tribes. There are three tribes in particular, Zagawa, Fur, and Masalit. And there were several tribes, several rebel movements formed at that time, and they've been splintering steadily, mostly along tribal lines ever since.
Samantha, anything you want to add to that?
Well, just that we saw, over the course of the 21-year civil war between Khartoum, between the Sudanese government and rebels in the south, which was also, for a movement for autonomy and for resources and out of a frustration that the Arab government was brutally treating the Africans living in that region. But that what the Sudanese government has tended to do is to respond to insurgency with genocide. So it's almost as if it doesn't know how to meet political demands. It doesn't know how to even think about negotiating political settlements or compromises or ceasing brutality. Instead, what it does is it classically tries to drain the swamp by displacing millions and millions of people and murdering hundreds of thousands of others.
We're talking about Darfur on WNYC with another deadline of midnight tonight for all parties to agree to a peace deal that they hope will end the genocide in Darfur. And we're talking about it with Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, and Samantha Power, the director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and author of Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which, if I remember correctly, Samantha, also won a Pulitzer?
Yeah, what happens is that if you write books or columns on mass atrocity, people give them prizes because it makes all of us feel like we want to do something. So what we do is we give prizes to people who write about it, but unfortunately we'd be better off doing something about the genocide itself.
So let's talk about what the United States might do about the genocide itself. And I want to play a clip of President Bush himself speaking about this the other day. You'll hear the initials AU, which refers to African Union.
We have got AU troops on the ground. Those troops need to be augmented and increased through strong United Nations action.
And Samantha, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick just flew to Nigeria yesterday, pledging to delve into these talks with the midnight deadline himself. So what do you make of that, and what do you make of President Bush speaking about troops?
Well, I think all the political pressure that has been applied to the Bush administration over the course of the last, specifically the last 2 years, has paid dividends. I mean, there is a high-level ownership of this issue. It's kind of spasmodic, but we've never seen a Deputy Secretary of State dispatched in U.S. history. I mean, somebody of that rank to deal with what could easily be written off as a kind of humanitarian problem, you know, problem just about human suffering. So that is the product of pressure. The crimes have been referred to the International Criminal Court, which the Bush administration is no fan of. That's the product of pressure. The funding for the AU and the funding for the refugee camps, the rations, it's all about pressure. I think President Bush has you know, really come around to see the importance of this issue. One of his advisors, Michael Gerson, is, I think, deeply committed to doing more. But to a degree, you know, the Bush administration, what it needs to be doing right now is the thing it does the least well, and that is delicate diplomacy behind the scenes, both to get Sudan's friends to peel away and to join the United States in pressuring Sudan, friends like China or countries within the Arab League, and then, crucially, to raise the troops that will be needed to do the augmentation and the increase that the president was talking about. That's not something we don't do behind the scenes well, and we haven't kept our eye on the ball with regard to Sudan. Our initiatives are very reactive to public pressure, and what we haven't seen is a sort of sustained and urgent roll-up-the-sleeves, you know, take-no-prisoners approach to actually mustering the coalition we need to be a part of.
Nicholas, what would you like to see the United States do? Because I think the first impulse of people, if they think the United States should act, is to think that, well, in the situation of a genocide in progress, maybe the only thing it can do is send in troops, which maybe only the United States has the muscle to do effectively.
Yeah, I don't think we should send in U.S. troops on the ground in Darfur. I think that, especially in the aftermath of Iraq, for the U.S. to send in ground troops into an Arab country would inflame the situation and would perhaps actually give President Bashir of Sudan a kind of nationalistic cause to buttress his own position in Sudan. But we can address the security situation in a couple of ways. We desperately need a UN force that would go in and would establish security, and that can be composed to a considerable extent of troops from Muslim countries to allay this kind of sensitivity, but it does need some NATO forces. The U.S. can supply airlift capacity and other help assistance to that UN force. And the U.S. and France together can also impose a no-fly zone, which would prevent Sudanese military aircraft from strafing villages, for example, and also would be one more way of putting pressure on the Sudanese government to actually stop the killing.
And Nicholas, we have to take a break in
sure.
20 seconds, but Osama bin Laden in that videotape warned against U.S. interference in Darfur. Was Osama bin Laden coming out in effect for genocide?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite extraordinary when you have Muslims being slaughtered in Darfur, hundreds of thousands of them, and of course the people in Darfur are essentially all Muslim. This is not a religious issue. And then to have President Bush, albeit much too lamely, speaking up for them.
We have to continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer with Nicholas Kristof and Samantha Power on WNYC.
We are optimistic that by Tuesday evening we can say that we will be able to achieve the peace and to have that agreement signed by the parties. This will really alleviate the suffering of the population in Darfur.
Let's hope he's right. That's Nordine Mesny, spokesperson for the African Union, talking about the midnight tonight deadline for signing this peace agreement with respect to Darfur. And we're continuing to talk about the deadline and the situation as a whole with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and Samantha Power, who is the executive director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and author of the book Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. And we have a lot of people calling in, so let's take some phone calls. It's 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And this is a Rabbi Ron Fish from Bridgeport. Rabbi, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I was at the rally in Washington on Sunday with a busload of people, actually from Norwalk and Westport, and it was really quite extraordinary and very moving to me, particularly when we saw a group of Sudanese refugees who were chanting for peace. The crowd, which was sort of strikingly Jewish and from all over, was there, I think, like we were, for theoretical reasons, with our kind of emotional connection to the idea of genocide. But here were people really chanting about their sisters and their husbands and their uncles being murdered. And it was quite moving. It was really a very powerful experience for me. I was struck by Russell Simmons' comments at the rally. I was really disappointed in it. It's something that Nicholas Kristof just mentioned sort of resonated for me. Russell Simmons talked about the fact that we shouldn't embrace the rebels, that the rebels are not exactly good guys, they're not Democrats, which I think is obviously true. But on the other hand, it sounded almost like he was shilling for the Sudanese government. And I was struck by that and concerned that maybe there was even an anti-colonial tinge to some of what he was suggesting was going on.
Samantha, are you aware of any such dynamic?
I don't know. I mean, I was a little alarmed by the comments myself, I must say, given, you know, what the rally was for and so on. But I think, you know, that is a perspective that is out there. It is, you know, around the world, in the developing world, but even in Europe, maybe even the predominant perspective. And what's so striking is when you go to Darfur, I mean, and you talk to people, I'm sure Nick can talk about it more recently than I can even, and they say, you know, we don't want African troops. The last thing we want is African troops. They are beholden to the Sudanese government. They're on the payroll, or they're only coming for the money that they get to join the AU force. And, you know, I personally am grateful that any African troops have gone at all, because, you know, other countries are so reluctant to get involved. But the Darfurians themselves say, you know, leave the Africans out of this. You know, they're beholden. We want the white people. And bring back the British, but, you know, bring in the Americans. You know, mm-hmm. They're not as turned off by the implications of the war in Iraq than I think, as Nick said, we should be. But so this colonial dynamic that he gave voice to, very unfortunately, at a rally, I think we have to take seriously. And if we are to bring other countries around, and those Muslim countries that Nick mentioned that are going to have to supply the peacekeeping forces, we're going to have to override that perspective, because that's what they think this is about.
Nicholas, does this even get back to what you were starting to say about Osama bin Laden before the break?
Yeah, I mean, I just think we need to be very sensitive to the nationalistic issues. It was our biggest mistake in Iraq, and, you know, we have to be sensitive to the fact that in Khartoum, for example, and elsewhere in the Arab world, I mean, you have this crazy situation, for example, where right now the only Arab member of the Security Council is Qatar, and Qatar has been supporting Sudan. Likewise, Egypt, you know, which is kind of the media center for much of the Arab world, has by and large been sympathetic to Sudan. And I do think that one of the things we really need to do, the administration needs to do more, is engage in public diplomacy on Darfur and, you know, bring in the Egyptians and Gulf Arabs and emphasize the degree to which Muslims are being slaughtered and to try to make this not just be an American dynamic, but something broader.
Let's take another call. Tedla in Flushing, you're on WNYC. Hi,
yeah.
Tedla.
Good morning, Brian. Yeah, my comment is that Darfur, they don't have any natural resources, no oil and nothing. The only thing the Sudanese government is worried is that this might complicate the deal they made with the Southern rebel movement, where they have a large natural resources. The rebels in the South, they are not helping their brothers with no oil. So the problem is not going to be solved by any force. Whether the UN is getting there, the Sudanese, the Darfurians, they have no sources. They have to live like anybody else. They have to deal with the Southern rebels is the most important thing for them. And I don't know how they will help them anyway.
Samantha, do you want to comment on the role of natural resources and the lack thereof in this?
Well, it's just, I mean, the caller's making the point that the irony of this, you know, imperial suspicion or the suspicion of the imperial power that is, you know, the United States is the only country really speaking out on this around the world. And our standing is such, and the cynicism perhaps of other countries is such, that the immediate assumption is, oh, there must be oil in Darfur. And the number of people in governments, in Western governments, who believe somehow that the U.S. position is the product of, you know, the traditional hunt for natural resources, perhaps is unsurprising given our record, but is very disturbing given, you know, just what Darfur does lack. I mean, there is talk of prospecting in Darfur, and you know, people, you know, are not sure what actually lies, you know, beneath the refugee camps now that are teeming with people. But the reality of the U.S. position right now is that it would love to just work with Sudan. The Bush administration would love to work with Sudan on counterterrorism. It would love to shore up the peace deal in the north and the south. It is doing Darfur in spite of its national interests rather than because of it. This isn't traditional economic and security interest stuff happening. It is the product of a response to domestic pressure.
Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yeah, good morning, Brian. I just want to ask your guest whether or not the violence in Darfur is hard for Americans to kind of understand, because, and how much do they have to edit out actually what's going on? Because I just feel that it's just hard to for us to conceptualize what's actually going on, and I just it seems to be so sanitized, and it's hard to really see what if you could see it online. I mean, Iraq bombings, anything. When you see it online, it makes it more real. I just wanted to see what your guest's response to that.
Nicholas?
I don't edit much out. I always feel like I'm making readers sick over the breakfast table sometimes, and I kind of try to do that by focusing on individuals. And you go anywhere in Darfur and you stop somebody under a tree, and they will talk about how their 2-year-old child was pulled out of their arms and beaten to death in front of them. Most of the people you see are women, because an awful lot of the men and boys have been killed. And everywhere you go, every village you go to, you find teenage girls who've been gang raped to terrorize them, women who've had small children killed, thrown in bonfires. I do think that, you know, I have the print medium to deal with, and I do think that print sometimes can't convey the horrors of it, and that it's much more natural for television to cover. And I think that if these kinds of scenes were on our television screens, then I think we would respond, and I think we would have taken action much earlier. But I think television has completely dropped the ball on Darfur.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and human rights activist Samantha Power, director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University, my guests on WNYC for another few minutes as we talk about the situation in Darfur, including the deadline of midnight tonight for this peace agreement among all the major parties, which they seem at the brink of agreeing to. And let's take another call. TC in Jamaica, you're on WNYC. Hello, TC.
Yeah, good morning, Brian, and good morning to your guests. It seems that the most up-to-date information that I'm able to receive and most of us are able to receive comes from Nicholas Kristof's columns and the websites. What I'm concerned about as an African-American is why it seems as if that the African-American churches and by and large, the African-American leadership has not picked up on this issue, and why it has not been a more resounding issue in our churches. I'm wondering if whether or not, African-Americans are not reading the New York Times or this issue. I'm just trying to figure out why it seems to be led primarily by Jewish organizations and groups, and why we haven't picked up on this issue.
Do you have any opinion as to why that might be yourself?
I've been trying to figure out whether or not the African-American churches, by and large, have been possibly, I don't want to say compromised, but there's so much faith-based, you know, programs in these churches, I don't know if whether or not there's something there. But I'd like Nicholas Kristof to address that, because I've been trying my very best to get this information out in my community through my little community newsletter, and I'm just wondering why the African-American pastors haven't picked this up. And also, Nicholas Kristof, I just wonder how safe it is for him, you know, to continue to go back and forth to Darfur. I was wondering,
right,
does he have any kind of, you know, real protection over there? I really worry about a guy like him who's getting this information out. I just want to know if whether or not he's...
Nick, it's always good to know somebody's worrying about you.
Yeah, my wife worries too. On the issue of the African-American community, I mean, it is true that there have been some... black leaders, the Congressional Black Caucus, for example, has played an important role, but that in general, the African-American community hasn't been as active, you know, as some other groups. And I mean, I think that's a legitimate concern. I mean, on the one hand, I think that it seems unfair to, you know, to say that American blacks should, you know, feel some kind of responsibility for leading the way on Africa. On the other hand, if American blacks don't, then who will? And so I think that is a constituency that if it were more active on Darfur, that would be great.
What would you suggest a person like myself do who has a community, I guess, newspaper or newsletter? I mean, is this an issue that I have to take to the pastors, take to the congregation, to the streets? Can you give me a suggestion?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, black churches would be an obvious constituency. African-American, you know, organizations or publications, you know, if they reported it more and it became more of an issue, then I think that would help a lot. There are groups like SaveDarfur.org, the website, that can give you more information. And indeed, there are some organizations that have been involved, but it would be great if there were, you know, if there were more.
TC, thanks a lot for your call and your concern. Samantha, what do you think will happen after midnight tonight if this agreement either is or is not reached?
Well, I mean, what the agreement paves the way for is the deployment, should pave the way for, is the deployment of an international force that will offer more protection. You know, as soon as there are two signatures on a piece of paper, that is meaningless for those people who are living in these refugee camps, who are still being raped and in the case of men, being killed by the Janjaweed, who remain, you know, who are patrolling all around. So the first thing that needs to happen is we got to protect those people in those camps. I mean, if they're not safe in the camps, how are they going to be safe when they return to their homes, when they're much more isolated and far from international aid workers and foreign forces? I think that the major challenge is going to lie in actually raising troops for that force, even if the Sudanese government can be pressured into allowing a UN force. People who have heard Sudan say, no, we'll never allow non-Africans into Sudan, should be reminded that they said the same thing about southern Sudan. They initially resisted a UN force there. So if we can get concerted international pressure around this peace deal, if it in fact is signed, then, you know, they will probably relent and allow troops in. But who's going to field them? Europe has gotten totally out of peacekeeping, UN peacekeeping in general, and especially out of peacekeeping in Africa. The United States will not send troops. Where are these middle powers that are going to step up and actually add and amplify, you know, this AU force? We don't want more of the same. And right now it's only the Bangladeshis, the Nepalese, the Uruguayans, countries like that, that are being approached by the United Nations, such as the overstretch by the few countries that are still contributing to the United Nations.
And supposedly Sudan has agreed to this deal, and they're waiting for the rebels on behalf of the people of Darfur to also agree, and they're the ones holding out. But here's a short clip of Yasser Abdussalam, the charge d'affaires for the Sudanese mission to the United Nations, just 2 days ago, as played on NPR.
I appeal to the American administration to just work for peace in Darfur instead of instigating parties and waging war.
So I appeal to the American administration to work for peace in Darfur instead of instigating and waging war. That doesn't sound like somebody who's ready to sign on to a peace agreement.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what we need to do is just use the Sudanese words against them. If they're interested in peace, they've shown they've signed this agreement. We need to alter the agreement so that it brings the rebels on board. But the key to peace is protection and is security for civilians. And it's the Sudanese who started this, you know, a genocide by actually butchering people in the first place, and B, who have now resisted the deployment of forces that can actually improve the welfare of civilians and ensure that people can return to their homes.
Here is Mo Tassin in Manhattan. He says he's president of the Darfur Association of New York. Mo Tassin, thank you for calling us. Good morning.
Good morning. I would like to make a comment on the deadline that's stated by the African Union. They submitted the proposal in 80 pages, and it is an English version, and they wanted the rebels group to assign a peace agreement, and at least they need 1 week to study the 80 pages. It is in English. They needed 5 days at least to translate it, and they submit the Arabic version just 1 day before the first deadline ends.
Very briefly, because we're going to run out of time, what is it that your concern might be in that fine print that would be against the interests of the people of Darfur?
It's actually the people of Darfur paid a lot, and it is unfair and injustice after killing of 400,000 people and displaced entire people of Darfur just to adopt the proposal of the Sudanese government. The African Union is, in fact, adopted the proposal of the Sudanese government. That's why the Sudanese government all accepted to sign the peace agreement at any time.
Because it's not going to protect the people of Darfur, really? Is that why?
Yes, of course.
Nicholas, we have about a minute left.
I mean, I just think it's very important to not to put too much faith in agreements, because the record is that Sudan has, I mean, in April 2004, after I began to cover this, Sudan signed a ceasefire, and several hundred thousand people may well have been killed since then. Sudan promised not to bother Chad, and since then it has sent a proxy invasion force to actually invade Chad. This has to be thought of as, you know, one step, but as not an end result.
And Samantha, briefly, you mentioned the camps before and the importance of protecting the people in the camps. I've read that there are 3 million people in the camps. You think that's relatively an accurate number? And are they not safe now?
No, that's where many of the killings are now going on. They're riper targets because they've all been gathered in one place. So when they go out for firewood and so on to cook the humanitarian aid, they're still very vulnerable. The peace won't stick unless people feel safe. And until people feel safe, there's not going to be a long-term peace. So getting that international force in there and spreading the movement that revealed itself on the Mall in Washington yesterday, spreading that movement around the world so that other governments are under similar pressure, to not be bystanders to genocide, that's the key to a long-term peace in Sudan.
Samantha Powers, Executive Director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and author of Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Nicholas Kristof is the New York Times columnist. We'll see what happens at midnight tonight. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.